This is the first real taped interview with Arthur Leggett in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 13th of the 1st, 2003, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Arthur, can we begin the interview by you telling us your full name and where and when you were born, please?
Yes, my name is Arthur Leslie Leggett. I was born in Balgowlah, one of the outer suburbs of Sydney, or was an outer suburb at the time, on the 8th of September 1918. Both my parents were Londoners. They came out here prior to the First World War, and my father was in the first AIF. He went to France as a member of the AIF, and he was unfortunately gassed and was returned home before the war finished. And as I stated, I was born in 1918.
The year that the war ended.
Yeah.
Tell us about growing up in Sydney.
Well, at that particular time, my first memories aren't in Sydney. They're up in northern New South Wales at a town called Bingra, where we had gone when I was a mere toddler. I thought at the time my father was running away from cities and people and everything else, but I have since been informed by an auntie that the main purpose of going there was he was after dry air for the sake of his lungs, because he spent the next 20 years dying. And unfortunately, of course, being a child, I wasn't aware of all this. From there, we moved to Moree, and I have neglected to state that my father was a bootmaker and boot repairer by trade, and he opened up a shop in Moree and had five men working for him when I started school there. We lived in Moree until I was 10 years of age, then we moved down to the suburb of Manly in Sydney, and I lived there until, well, for the next 5 years. When my father came out to Australia, he came out with several sisters who stayed here in Perth. And as he got less capable of getting around, he wanted obviously to be with his sisters, and we came back here to Western Australia in 1934. And I suppose you could say my teenage years and my working life, such as it was prior to the war, was here in Perth.
So around about 15, 16, you were here in Perth.
I was 14 when we arrived in Perth.
In relation to your father's situation, had he ever spoken to you as a boy about the First World War at all?
Well, Dad never got onto any specific topic. He didn't hide from it, but of course all his mates had been in the army too. I think just about every male in Australia had got involved in that army. And RSL meetings and activities after the 14-18 war, we attended those because that was how you kept contact with the community then. There was no radio, there was no TV, and there was no big orchestras, and people used to get together, and mainly the old soldiers were hanging together because they needed the companionship of each other, from what I can estimate now. And in this way, I learnt quite a bit from his mates as much as I did from him.
What were some of the things that you learnt about the First World War as a boy?
Oh, well, we were fighting the Germans. I didn't even know who the Germans were, of course. And my father, of course, he went straight away. I'll do that bit again. Dad enlisted in the Australian Imperial Forces because England was his homeland, and that's where they were going to fight for England, and it was the obvious thing to do. And so away he went, although he did not join up in 1914 because he was roughly 5'3½" tall, and it took him some time before they would admit him or accept him into the army. And because I knew nothing about all this. And he was trained with the rest of the Australians in Salisbury, and he went to France. He wasn't there long. Actually, from the time he enlisted till the time he was discharged was 19 months, and that's how long it took.
In relation to some of the stories you may or may not have been aware of, what was the image that you had of the First World War as a boy?
It was something that happened before I was born, put it that way, and yet it was something that bound the community together after the war. That's the feeling I had because I was alive at that time, and you could feel it because, as I said, all your dad's mates all got together periodically and regularly for entertainment and community activity.
What were your impressions as a boy of what war was like, what the First World War was actually like?
Oh, I had no idea. I had some idea they dug holes and hid in holes and fired guns at each other, but beyond that I had no impression at all. No.
You mentioned, obviously, that you were in Sydney in 28, the age of 10, and then for the next 5 years. Obviously, growing up in Sydney from that time through the Depression years, what was it like?
Well, whilst in Sydney, of course, I was not aware of the Depression. I was still going to school. And Manly, where we were living, was a wonderful place for a young fella to grow up, a boy, to mature. There was the ocean, there was the swimming in the harbour side of it, there were forests quite nearby, and as a kid, there would be a bunch of us, around 10, 11, we would just go camping for the weekend, and there would be no problems at all, you just go. Nowadays, of course, it's doubtful whether you should let your kids do this, but we used to, and we made tin canoes out of galvanised iron, we floated around on the harbour, we just enjoyed life very much indeed. We went to school, and at the same time, had no knowledge of the economic problems your parents were facing up to while you were growing up. It's as simple as that. Mm.
It's an interesting point you make. The Depression then not really affecting you as a kid?
Not until we came to Perth, because when we got to Perth, we were in a pretty desperate strait, so I wasn't aware of this, but I turned 14, therefore I could leave school and I had to get a job. And I got a job in Perth, of all things, as a messenger boy. And I never knew one street from another around the city. And in order to get that job, I put my age back 6 months. The accountant of the firm wanted to see my birth certificate, and I kept putting him off, saying it was in Sydney, I had to get it. But after about 10 months, I had to produce it. Then they said, well, you put your age back 6 months, that means that we will have to pay you an extra $2.06 a week. So they fired me. And that was the end. I was out of work then. And from there, I got a job on a farm. And I was roused about on the farm for about 10 months. I learnt to ride a horse, milk a cow, kill a sheep, all the usual things, feed horses, because it was all horse-drawn in those days. The farmer, well, not the farmer, the community had a bad season, and there was obviously going to be a very poor crop, and he had to send me back down to Perth. Meanwhile, my father, whose health was failing, had taken a job as a hospital orderly at Laverton Hospital, which was a long way from anywhere. The local dairy farmer needed a boy to help him with the dairy at Laverton. And I went up there because there was no work in the city. I went up there and I worked on this dairy for 6-8 months. The chappie who ran the dairy, he had it on lease from the station owner. He shot through to Kalgoorlie, did a midnight flit with his wife and kids. And at the age of 16, I was getting up milking 30 cows and doing the milk run and all this sort of thing around Laverton and the Beria gold mine. In due course, the station owner, this is the cattle station owner, his son came in to take over the dairy because my service was no longer required there. I got a job as a dishwasher and spud peeler at the boarding house of the gold mine. I had that job for about 6 months, but obviously I was getting homesick and Mum decided to get me back home. She had a couple of boarders at her place then, because that's the only way we could knock up a few bob. Dad was in a convalescent home out at the Victoria Park, Edward Millen home for diggers with his problem, and there was quite a few of them there. And one of the boarders was a boilermaker. They were putting extensions on East Perth Powerhouse at the time, and he got me a job there as a rivet heater with this structural steel firm, which was called the Structural Engineering Company of Western Australia. And I worked with them. We also built the COR oil compound down at North Fremantle. We built the original hangars at Pearce Aerodrome. And, when the war started, of course, I moved out then and joined the Army.
So what year was it that you would have come back to Perth, roughly? From your Laverton experience?
About 1937, I suppose, somewhere around there.
What had you been hearing up until this time about changing political situation in Europe?
Well, we knew there's a black call Hitler stamping around. Yes, everyone knew that, of course. That was over in Europe. With none of them. Well, wouldn't worry us, no.
Given the fact that it was over in Europe, what were your allegiances to Britain, for instance, as a personal...
Yeah, well,
you mentioned your father going off to fight for his country, but how did you see it?
Well, that's a situation nowadays I try to come to grips with, and I still find it very hard. In our lounge room, we've always had photos of the Buckingham Palace, Paul's Cathedral, and Westminster Abbey. They were always on the wall of our house. My uncles and aunts were all in England. In school every morning, you'd form up in your classes and select the flag, and England was the motherland, and such was our way of indoctrination and education that when the war broke out, I couldn't get in the army quick enough because the motherland was in trouble. Simple as that. And so I had been 3 years in the militia before the war, but as soon as the AIF Corps went out, I enlisted straight away.
What had driven you to the militia, do
you think? A desire to be of some use, I suppose, but my dad, rather than all his mates, had been in the army, and as soon as I was old enough, I joined the militia, but again, it was a way of life amongst the younger generation, and... We weren't very keen on American rock and roll characters or how to kick a man when he's down and all these wonderful things that were taught nowadays by TV. We wanted to develop and grow and become citizens, and that was the driving force. And there's about 1,000 men on the Cameron Highlanders who thought the same. And it was one of the most, formative years of my life, because there were some wonderful men in there. And you sort of set up your icons and live accordingly.
Hmm. I'm interested, were you given a choice in relation to a militia force to join? Was literally the Cameron Highlanders the only one you could get?
Oh, well, the glamour, I suppose, of the Cameron Highlanders. You could join any militia unit you liked. That's your option. And with the Cameron Highlanders, I just joined up, went along on the night they were enlisting. And fortunately, I met up with a joker who eventually became a brother-in-law. And he said, well, look, get in the horse transport if you can ride a horse. So I got in the transport section, and in those days it was horses, which was part of the magic of being alive as a teenager. And there was horse drill once a month, one Sunday a month, there would be a horse drill, and which was done out at Guildford, where the golf course is out there, where Rosemount Golf Course, that was all scrubbed. And we used to go, well, there's a remount depot out there then. You'd get the train from Perth, come out to Guildford, walk across there, because no one had a car, no one had a bike. People sort of overlooked these minor things, but that's the only way you could get around, was by public transport. But that's getting back to your question. You could join whatever unit you like. The glamour of being in a Highland regiment, I think, had a lot to do with it. You had to cough up £5 of your own money to help pay for the uniform. So you had to be a bit keen to get into it, which I think lifted the standard of lad that was in the thing.
Kilts were a part of that uniform.
Oh, yes, the Cameron Highland, the Cameron of Erith was the kilt, and they were made by the Albany Woolen Mills. And there was a bit of a hold up there for a while. We didn't get them immediate. We had to hang around for about, well, the unit was going for the best part of 6 to 12 months before we issued with kilt. It was quite, and it was a solid one. They had a pipe band of about 30 men. And it was a very intriguing thing to be in, very glamorous and traditional too, of course.
What was the feeling then on parade, on marching through the suburb, for instance? Locals and how they saw you?
Well, the only time we really marched as a regiment, to my knowledge, would be on Anzac Day. There might have been a few regimental occasions like a church parade or something of this nature. But, of course, there was always this traditional pride of being part of a regiment with historical background, part of the British traditions, and we were awfully British in those days. It all added up to making you feel as though you were somebody and something, and give you a purpose in being alive instead of just drifting around the streets.
In relation to some of the things that Hitler, I mean, you mentioned Hitler was stomping around the place. Mm-hmm. What were some of the strongest impressions that you have of some of that stomping?
Well, of course you'd see a newsreel of his troops goose-stepping around the place, and that used to give sense to a certain amount of ridicule because it was a stupid way to get around, we used to think, being Australian, and actually you'd be right, mate. I know the generation before me was worrying about it because they had already been through a war and they knew what Germany was capable of doing. But as far as we were concerned, it wasn't until 1939 that we began to realise that there could be a war. Mm. But I don't think we'd give a great deal of thought to him. No.
There was talk of him violating the Versailles Treaty in 1936 and going into the Rhineland and then wanting more and more. Had you been aware of that in relation to where he was marching, for instance?
Yes, we knew that he was expanding, and we knew he was wanting some of the corridor and things of this nature, and he was just stomping in again and doing it. We thought, oh, that's awfully wrong, but outside of that, I don't think we worried about it.
Demanding the Sudetenland in 1938. Obviously, marching into Prague.
I think the biggest thing that hit us was when he walked into Vienna, into Austria.
Hmm.
That was that made people realise that this was getting a bit serious.
That was 1939, so... What was up until that time, England had been appeasing him, and so France had sort of been letting things slide. Do you remember Chamberlain coming back with peace?
Oh, yes, I remember that quite clearly. And we felt at the time he may have achieved something, but at this stage it was getting rather serious about the whole situation there, and I think the attitude was that the bastard wants fight, we'll give it to him. Without really realising what such a statement meant and what you would have to go through to do that.
Because there was a certain period and a number of... many people admired Hitler for a while, didn't they?
Yes, they did, because they realised, some people anyway, realised Germany was down and they were greatly climbing up. And you also... you got people that looked at him with a certain amount of envy as to what he was achieving, because Australians always like a winner. But we didn't realise how evil he was, put it that way. And as far as I'm concerned, Hitler and his Nazi party were just a cancerous growth on a rather fine nation. That's how I see it now. But of course, in those days, I didn't realise it.
So there's talk of another war possibly around the corner. Did people believe Chamberlain when he came back?
Oh, I don't really know. I can't answer that positively because that was in England. Mm. That was a long way away.
When it became serious, obviously, the promise from Britain and France to back Poland, if it came to it, in March. Obviously, it's not long before Poland itself is attacked. What was the feeling then in September, on September 3rd?
Oh, we got to have a go at him, yeah. We've got to have a go, because that was when the line was drawn. Put it that way, he had been annexing different bits and pieces around Europe, but that was an open invasion, and therefore, being British and having said we're going to stand by Poland, well, we just had to have a go.
So what was the feeling then when people heard that the war really was on?
Well, I think, well, I know with amongst the younger generation, that's my generation, was a sense of excitement and a certain amount of adventure. With the older generation, though, there was a lot of unhappiness, because that, well, it was only 20 years ago, and goodness me, they're still under the influence of it. And when I talk about working as a kid, well, the foreman, when I was a messenger boy, he was a corporal in the First World War. The boss I had up in the goldfields when I was working on the dairy, he showed me his arm. It was all splintered with bits of shrapnel in it. And he said they used to come out of his big toe in a bath and just work their way through his body. So that whole generation still had the influence of the war with them, and they knew what it was. But the younger...
Did that deter you at all?
No, no. It won't happen to me. Oh, no, you join the army. No, it's not going to happen to you. It's going to happen to everyone else. But, you're going to get through all right. Yeah.
Did anyone give you advice? Don't join them?
No. No, I never heard that comment anywhere. No. No. But, I wish they had have.
Would you have listened?
No, of course not. No, I was a Cameron Highlander. And furthermore, the commanding officer of the Cameron Highlanders was promoted to the rank of colonel and given the job of being colonel of the 2nd Leyden Battalion. So, right, got to stick with the old bloke, stick with the colonel. So away we go. Oh, a lot of the Cameron Highlanders immediately enlisted.
People talk of being in the Cameron Highlanders and then going off and joining the Navy or the Air Force.
Yeah.
Did you ever consider doing that?
Joining the...
Going off to join the Air Force or the Navy?
Oh, no. I was one of the most naive characters you could find around at the time. And to me, I was going to join the Army. End of story. And I had no idea what was really meant by it. The same when I joined the Cameron Highlanders, as I told you, a fellow exerted his influence and told me to get in the horse transport. And all the other branches of the Army, I had no idea of their existence or how they worked or anything else. I was just joining the Army. But there's a lot like me. We see, Australia is so far away from Europe, so isolated from all the influences of Europe, and it's very hard for us to realise what's going when one nation's border is just a line drawn on the ground. I mean, we had the ocean right around us. Furthermore, Mother England was protecting us, and it's very hard to realise just how dangerous it can be living in another nation like that. That's the way we felt at that time anyway.
The sense of adventure you mentioned, obviously a chance to see the world.
Oh, there's a big chance outside of seeing the world that I would eventually meet my uncles and aunts in England, and because I couldn't see me ever getting there any other way, because prior to the war, nobody had two bob to rub together. And so there was all my uncles and aunts that Mum and Dad had been talking about all my lifetime, chance to see them, plus seeing the countries that my dad had seen. We'd been a lot to talk over after the war, different places we'd been in the same spots. And it doesn't work out that way, but that's what was in my mind at that time.
What did the training involve? Actually joining up for the militia initially?
From the militia.
Initially, what was it like being in the militia and then obviously transferring?
Oh, well, the militia was... you wanted to be in the militia because it was a good thing to be in. Esprit de corps, comradeship, mateship and all that sort of thing. And there was the glamour, as I say, of being in a Highland regiment from my point of view, plus the fact the excitement of riding horses once a month. And when we went into our annual camp, we were in charge of horses for the whole week or 10 days, that was all wonderful part of being alive. I mean, you're healthy, you're a teenager, you're with mates who think the same as you, and you're all working through a common objective, produce a good regiment. And therefore, the 3 years I spent in the militia eventually were wasted, because when I joined the AIF, there wasn't any horses. They were all trucks, and I didn't fancy that, so I joined the signal platoon. But outside of that, okay, you were discharged from the Cameron Highlanders and you enlisted in the AIF. That's what it was. You were advised you will receive a letter from the authorities to report such and such a place. Well, we all had a report to, I think it was Perth Railway Station, and we were taken to Northam. And from there, we were gradually equipped with gear, but of course we were right over here on the west. So they shipped the whole lot of us over to the east so that they could apparently build up a brigade strength or something of this nature and work together. And there we were equipped with uniforms and rifles and gear, all stamped 1918, which is obsolete to hell, but we were going to fight a war with this. Being a signal, I even had two flags to signal with. Can you imagine being in the front line with two flags? I had a heliograph and a Lucas lamp, all this 1918 stuff. But that's how we thought at that time.
Did you know what the enemy had?
No. No, we never. In fact, we got a bit blasé there, I think, to a certain extent, because our first encounter was with the Italians in the Western Desert. Well, as history tells you, we romped through there and had a wonderful time. So we weren't really interested in what the enemy had. We were winning. It was only when we got up into Greece and Crete. That's basically.
I'm interested to talk about that. Obviously, the first few months of the war, from 39 through to the time that the British invaded, the Germans invaded France, Belgium, had been seen as a bit of a phony war. To what degree did that sort of give you a false sense of security, do you think?
Oh, I don't. Possibly. I don't know. We worried a great deal about that. You see, we were in Palestine training to be desert soldiers. And we were devoted to that purpose, put it that way, exercised and trained to that commitment. What was going on in France and so on, well, we knew about it, but we knew we were going to belt them back in due course. There's no doubt about that. We were going to just trundle them back as soon as we felt in the mood.
Tell us what it was like to prepare to leave and then to finally head off
from Australia. Oh well, again, the sense of adventure came in there. I had a pretty good time, in as much that having spent my boyhood in Manly, and we were camped on the suburbs of Manly, Greta and Liverpool, in the, well, Rutherford. No, not Rutherford. We were kicked out of there. Ingleburn. Well, weekend leave, I'd be over in Manly, and there I'd be with all my teenage schoolmates. They're all grown up to be teenagers and young people, and because I had a pretty good time there. Eventually we left there, well, I said ta-da to all them, and we're home here for a few weeks. I think it was about 6 weeks we were back in Western Australia. And at there's a sense of adventure building up all the time. I think the older generation were a bit proud of us young blacks, what we were setting out to do, because, well, that's old school time, all that sort of thing, and plus the rural Britannia, because the population was very pro-British, and, strongly pro-British, is not word, strongly British, and we're all descended from the British, 99% of us. And there was a strong sense of patriotism and pride in our the younger generation that were going away, with a strong desire to finish the job properly this time, sort of thing. I had a few farewell parties which were hilarious, quite good. Eventually, the day I left, now the evening I left, I said ta-da to my mum and dad out in the street. They were standing on the street and shook hands with my dad. Never embraced him, and you didn't do that sort of thing. Shook hands with Dad, said, tell her Dad. I walked up the corner, turned around, tossed them a salute, and disappeared around the corner and got on the tram. And I learned years later, Dad turned around and he said, poor little bugger, he doesn't know what he's letting himself in for. That's, you know, that's part of the business of getting away.
Must have been difficult for your mum.
Oh, my mum, I don't know how she stood it, because Dad passed away during the course of the Second World War while I was in a prisoner of war camp. So there's two of us, and the other one was up in the islands. And so that's, yes, it got a lot of strength.
How did you feel leaving at that time? Did you feel concerned?
No.
Saddened?
No, no. I knew damn well that the next time I saw Western Australia would be the important one. And, but no, it's not going to happen to you, it's going to happen to someone else. That's how you feel, of course. Well, you've got to feel that way. But, no, there was a sense of adventure. But, and, of course, you're in a battalion. You're united into a pretty solid sort of a unit. There's esprit de corps, comradeship, and all this sort of thing, and there was strength within that.
So heading down the Fremantle Wharf, what was that like?
Oh, well, we were camped at Claremont at the time, Claremont Showgrounds, and I think we got on the train, that's right. It was top secret, of course, we were leaving, and there's thousands of people there to see us off. We got on the troop ship called the Navassa, which was a barge that was due for the scrap heap, and the war broke out, and they used it as a troop ship.